Tinti U, Sanyue 12, 291 ASC. Friday, March 12th, 2410 GSC. Air Temple Island, Yue Bay, Dicho. Early evening on Air Temple Island was one of the more peaceful times of the day for the people living there. The sun was just setting over the Mose Sea, casting the island in long shadows from the temple buildings. The evening meal had already passed, and most of the air acolytes were either studying, meditating, or engaged in the minor tasks needed to maintain the structures on the island, which in their own way were a form of meditation. One of the acolytes was taking his time sweeping the stones of the airbending training area near the turning gates. With smooth, regular strokes, he brushed the litter from the rock around him towards the bamboo garden that bordered the area. The evening breeze stirred the bamboo, causing a pleasing rustle that was soothing to the spirit. As such, he initially paid the slow stirring of the airbending gates no mind. Such things often happened as the wind crossed over the island, situated as it was between Yue Bay and the sea beyond. However, he began to take notice as the spinning of the gates became more intense, and he stopped his work to take a quick look around. None of the masters or their children appeared to be nearby, so for a moment he was puzzled as to what could be causing this phenomenon. Then he began to see the figures, intermittently, through the spinning gates. They at first seemed to be mirages, but as he watched, they began to appear more solid, though still half-formed through the blurring wood panels. There was only one person who could do that. He immediately set aside his broom to hurry back to the main compound. The masters had to be informed. The Avatar had returned. Between the spinning, airbending gates, Avatar Korra twisted and whirled, dancing the fine arc between the spirit and material worlds. She felt the sweet caress of spirit energy around her, danced along the curves of reality, and led herself and her traveling companions through the veils to their destination. The world flickered around her, shifting into a single clear image, which she resolutely moved toward. By the time Korra stepped off the platform, the gates were just beginning to slow down. She performed a little hop forward, to provide room for her friends to finish the transit without being hit by the spinning panels. She knew just how much that could put a damper on one's day. Smiling, she turned around to face them, performing a quick head count, though she would have known immediately if there had been any problem. Five, well, or six, depending on how you reckoned it, people, one tiger, as expected. She was intrigued to note, just for an instant, that the brand on Corbin Ravenhair's forehead had been glowing. It had gone out just as she turned to look at him. That light was the sign of what she interpreted as his Aesir equivalent of the Avatar state. She supposed simply standing amid what they'd been doing was enough to resonate with his celestial blood. "Everything go okay back there?" she asked, receiving nods, murmurs of agreement, and thumbs-up gestures in reply. "Good, good." "Yeah, looks like we're all in one piece," Utena Tenjo trailed off, as she finally noticed the view across the bay. "Oh, wow." Korra grinned, watching their faces as they took in the view, especially the faces of Utena and Anne Cross. She knew that look very well, for she had once worn the same expression of wide-eyed amazement upon witnessing the soaring skyscrapers and pagoda towers nestled in the mountain valleys beyond, the suspension bridges crossing the rivers of the harbor, the patrol and commuter airships weaving their way across the skies. "As a wise and noble hobo once said to me," Korra said as she turned forward once more, and gestured out towards the gleaming, sunset-gilded skyline. "Welcome to Republic City." "I have a message from another time." Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, No. 5. Suite for Trinity and Avatar, the Dicho Suite. First Movement, Honeymoon by the Sea, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, that's me, and Philip J. Moyer. "It's amazing," said Utina, and she meant it. Ever since the first time she'd seen it, New Avalon had been her benchmark for amazing big cities, but Republic City could contend in the same weight class. It wasn't as big or as tall. To get all of New Avalon into the frame, you'd have to be a lot further back, but it might well have been as handsome. And its architectural idiom was recognizably very different, even at this distance. She was already looking forward to getting a closer look, a much closer look, at it. With all that to look at, it was a minute or so before anyone in the group had occasion to turn around and check out the other view, that of the place where they had just arrived. This was worth a second look as well, in its own way. A handsome collection of blue-roofed buildings set in neatly manicured grounds, giving the impression that it might be a small and prosperous college or vacation retreat. The local skyline was dominated by a single tall tower, made taller still by having been constructed atop the highest point of land in the vicinity. With evening coming on, lights began appearing in the windows of various buildings, while the grounds were illuminated by what appeared to be gas lamps and occasional torches. "This is Air Temple Island," Cora explained, leading the way along a smoothly paved stone path around what appeared to be a martial arts practice ring of some sort or another. "Home to one of the world's five communities of air acolytes. They're monks who study the ways of the ancient nomadic airbenders and tend to the modern-day air nomads when they pass this way." "Do they eventually graduate and become nomads themselves?" Anne wondered, but Cora shook her head. "The acolytes aren't airbenders," she said. "They follow the air nomads' old ways to honor them, but so far as we know, no amount of study can make a bender out of someone who wasn't born with the gift." She spied movement in the distance and smiled. "Speaking of which, here comes someone who was." Following Cora's eyeline, the others looked up toward the tower and saw a flying shape, its path curving gracefully through the air to describe a gentle spiral down toward them. As it drew nearer, this remarkable figure turned out to be a man, tall and thin, dressed in saffron and yellow robes, and riding what appeared to be a very large fan or kite. As he alighted near them, he spun the fan in his hand and caused it to collapse into a 6-foot-long staff, which he then leaned in the crook of a nearby tree limb to free his hands. This close, Cora's companions could see that he was long-faced, gray-eyed, and pale, balding and sporting a neatly trimmed iron-gray mustache. A wide blue arrow tattoo curved up and over his scalp, pointing downward between his eyebrows. He was one of those men who wore middle age ambiguously, with no particular clues as to which end of that long curve he was really at. "Avatar Cora," he said gravely, placing his right fist against the open palm of his upright left hand and bowing his head. "Master Rohan?" Cora replied, making the slightly different salute of her own native water tribe, right fist loosely enclosed in left hand, in return. Then the two smiled and performed a complicated secret handshake before embracing like the old friends they obviously were. "Welcome home," said Rohan in a much warmer, less formal tone of voice. "And you've brought us visitors," he went on, turning to face the group she'd brought with her. His long face lighting up with delight, he cried, "Corwin," and gave the young man a hug as well, then bowed deeply to Caitlin and said he was very pleased to see her again. "Rohan, I want you to meet some new friends," said Cora cheerfully. "This is Utina Tenjo, Corwin's new bride," she went on, tossing Utina a wink. Their wedding was earlier today, and this is Auntie Tenjo, her wife. If Rohan thought there was anything strange about that, he was a master thespian indeed, because nothing but pleasant welcome showed on his face as he bowed first to one lady, then the other, even going so far as to kiss Anthe's hand and declare himself enchanted. Anne Cross, Caitlin's Kenjutsu student, Cora went on, putting a hand on the young girl's shoulder. Identifying her as a martial artist got the airbender salute for her, which, after a half-second's hesitation, she answered with the one for firebenders Cora had shown her the night before. That got a raised eyebrow and a twinkle-eyed little smile out of Rohan, causing Anne to blush slightly. "And this," Cora finished, "is Sergei." Caitlin was amused to see that even the unflappable airbender, who hadn't reacted even a little bit to Cora's matter-of-fact capsule summary of the Raven-Hair Tenjo domestic situation, was taken slightly aback by the sight of a full-grown tiger, and further amused to see that it was only slightly, after which he gave the tiger a bow and a pleasant greeting just as if he had been an honored human visitor to the island. "Now, it's pretty late in the evening where we just came from," said Cora pragmatically as Rohan collected his glider staff from the tree and they all set off along the path again. "So the first order of business should be to get everyone's quarters figured out. Which won't be that hard, come to think of it. Anthe, Kate, Anne, you'll be staying with me in the ladies' dormitory," she went on, gesturing to one of the buildings. "As for you two," she added to Corwin and Utina, "you should head into town. Remember the Phoenix House, Corwin?" "Hard to forget," he said with a smile. Cora grinned. "True. Go there and give the person at the desk my card," she said, handing him such an object. "They'll take care of you. You're set up for 3 nights. It's all taken care of. My wedding present to the pair of you," she added, her grin becoming a bit sentimental. "Wow," said Corwin. "Thanks." "Yes, thank you," Utina added earnestly. "When you return to the island on Monday," Rohan told them, "the Grand Lotus wishes to speak with you. I trust you received her token?" "Do you mean this?" Utina asked, removing from her shorts pocket the white lotus paisho tile Izumi had given her at the end of the wedding. "I do," said Rohan with a smile. "Excellent. Not that she would refuse to see you if you hadn't packed it," he added wryly, "but she does love her symbols, and I've found it's generally best to humor her." Corwin chuckled, an I-get-it sort of chuckle, and said, "It's Jinora, isn't it?" "Of course it is," said Rohan cheerfully. "Did you even entertain for a moment the notion that she might let someone else be in charge of something?" "No, you're right, that would be foolish," Corwin agreed. "I'd be happy to accept her invitation. It'll be good to see her again, even if she's in one of her serious moods." "But in the meantime," said Caitlin, nudging Utrina with an elbow, "you two have some honeymooning to do." "You've missed the last ferry to the mainland for the night," Rohan said. "But never mind about that. We can arrange..." Suddenly, a huge and shaggy shape appeared, looming up as if out of nowhere. An immense animal, easily the size of a truck or even a small railway car, lunged out of the dark and knocked Corwin to the ground between its massive forepaws, uttering a great bestial roar as it did so. Heart pounding, Anne jumped back a few paces and snatched her sword from her back, readying it for the draw, and then hesitated as 3 realizations struck her startled consciousness at once. The giant beast, though mostly cream-colored, had an arrow of brown fur on its head in almost exactly the shape of Rohan's tattoo. Caitlin and Rohan were just standing there with quiet little smiles, obviously amused, not dismayed. Kate was even photographing the scene. And, far from being in crisis mode herself at this sudden development, Korra was instead laughing fit to bust. The Avatar had collapsed against Rohan's shoulder, genuinely racked with the kind of laughter with it came in sobbing bursts between sharp, convulsive gasps for breath, while tears squeezed out of her tightly closed eyes and streamed down her face. At which point, as a confused Anne lowered her weapon, the monster, put out a giant red tongue the size of a sleeping bag and licked Corwin, who was trying, with little success, to fend it off. "Okay, okay, come on, Mogi. It's good to see you, too," he laughed, dragging himself from under the beast and climbing to his feet. He reached and dug his fingers into the shaggy brown fur of the creature's forehead arrow, scruffling diligently. With a sound that Anne figured Sergei's satisfied grunt would be like if the tiger weighed 10 tons, the beast sagged to the left and then collapsed on his side in a vast and undignified 6-legged sprawl, eyes rolling with contentment. "Oh, oh, oh, man," Korra gasped, wobbling unsteadily away from Rohan and wiping at her eyes. "Oh, I wish we had a picture of that." "We do," said Kate, waggling her mini-camera, to which Korra responded with a wordless sound of delight and a jumping hug. "What just happened?" Utrina wondered. "Just Mogi renewing acquaintances," said Rohan with a fond smile. "He hasn't seen Corwin in quite some time, but a sky bison never forgets his master." Corwin looked up from scruffling the bison and blinked. "His what?" he asked. Rohan eyed him. "Didn't you know?" Korra looked from one man to the other, then laughed again, less explosively but still wholeheartedly. "Of course he didn't know, Rohan," she said. "This is Corwin we're talking about." She crossed to the young god and hooked an arm around his neck, which was really only possible because he was still bent into his bison-scruffling position, and continued, "He thinks if you're 5 and you give a sky bison calf an apple, all it means is, 'Hey, little guy, have an apple.'" She tilted her head to look him in the face. "You did, didn't you?" "I don't know, I was 5. Corwin objected, then frowned. "No, wait. Yeah, I did. I remember now. I had one from dinner when I went back out to the cave that night. Mogi was the only one who came out to see me, so I gave it to him. Sort of an apology for, you know, stealing his mom." Rohan whacked his arrow with the heel of one hand. "Oh, for," he said, but the rest was lost in semi-audible mumbling. Corwin looked at him, then the bison, then Korra. "I always thought he was Ikki's," he said lamely. "So did I," Korra admitted. "But I guess she just looks after him while you're away, which is basically all the time." "Man," she said, petting Mogi herself. "No wonder he's so lazy." "Hmm," said Corwin. He sat down on the ground next to Mogi's head, one hand still buried in the bison's fur, while the other rubbed his own head thoughtfully. "Now I feel kind of awful," he concluded after a few moments' thought. "Well, you didn't know," Korra pointed out, sitting down beside him. "And none of the airbenders," she added with a pointed glance at Rohan, "who evidently did," a second glance from which Rohan looked away uncomfortably, "saw fit to tell you." "I'm very confused right now," Utrin mused. "Well," said Corwin, "remember how you were saying the other day that maybe we should all get a dog?" He made a sort of ta-da gesture toward the bison. "This is better." Utrina stepped closer. Mogi clambered to his feet, took a couple of snuffling breaths in her direction, then gave her a lick that set her back a pace or two, and grumped contentedly before turning to introduce himself, a bit more sedately, to the others. Utna blinked a couple of times, brushed at her shirt, and then shrugged and said agreeably, "We're going to need a bigger yard." Corwin chuckled. "In New Avalon, we haven't got a yard at all," he said. "Plenty of roof, though." He stood up, then took Cora's hand so she could pull herself upright as well. "We'll have to look into the import-export regulations for Dicho megafauna. Ah, geez, aren't sky bison endangered?" "They once were, but not for some time now," Rohan said. "You should run it by Jinora before you leave, all the same. But since you'll be speaking with her in a few days anyway..." Cora shook her head with an indulgent smile. "An earthbender with a sky bison. You just gotta be you, don't you, Corwin?" "Kaisu, Technon?" Cora replied sarcastically, making Cora chuckle. "On the plus side, you just solved your transportation problem for tonight," she added cheerfully. "Come on, Rohan, let's get him saddled up." This was a complicated process, but with the aid of several cheerfully drafted air acolytes, it didn't take long, and presently Mogi was outfitted with a saddle appropriate to his magnificence. It wasn't really a saddle at all in any conventional sense, since his back was much too wide for any human being to sit astride of, but rather a sort of solid platform with raised edges, handholds, and places to secure baggage, sufficient for several people and their effects. Cora and Rohan secured the couple's bags at the back of the platform, while Utrina and Corwin said their goodbyes for the evening. Anthy was pleased to find that she only had to assure them once that she would be perfectly fine until Monday and they should go, have a wonderful time, and not worry about her at all. Real progress, she felt, was being made. Then Rohan, with impeccable courtliness, showed Utrina the proper way of climbing up to the saddle with dignity and tact. Corwin didn't follow her. Instead, he clambered up onto the top of Mogi's great head and took hold of the rein attached to his horns. "Hey, Corwin, aren't you forgetting something?" Cora asked with a sly smile as Corwin prepared for takeoff. "What?" he wondered. She wound up and tossed him an item which jingled as he reflexively caught it, a small leather sack, which, when opened, proved to contain a roll of paper money and a number of gold and silver coins. "For expenses," said Cora, winking. "Have a great time. See you Monday." Corwin grinned, closed the purse again, and tucked it away inside his shirt, and replied, "Thanks. See you guys later." Then, twitching the reins, he declared, "Mogi, yip yip." "Vroom," Mogi replied agreeably. The bison gathered himself, his great bulk seeming to coil like a spring, and then leaped into the air with a mighty sweep of his broad, flat tail. And they were off, the cheerful parting cries of their companions fading away behind them. Cora waved until she was confident they wouldn't be able to see her anymore, then turned to the others and said, "Okay, that's those two out of our hair for a while. Who wants to try pine pear pie?" Mogi swept out over UA Bay, moving rather more swiftly than his erstwhile billing as the laziest sky bison in the world might have caused one to expect. This was Utina's first experience with flying on something that didn't at least have seats, and she had expected to find it a little more daunting than she did. There was such a reassuring feeling of stability up here, though, between the sturdy construction of the saddle and the muscular solidity of the animal himself, that she found herself no less confident in her safety than she would have been on the ground. She made her way forward until she was leaning over the low wall-like pommel at the front of the saddle, within arm's reach of Corwin in the pilot's seat. "Not bad, eh?" Corwin asked, glancing back at her with a grin. The evening was cool but not cold. The overall experience reminded Utna of rushing down a freeway in an open car, but with virtually no noise other than the whisper of Moki's slipstream passing by them. In front of them, the vista of Republic City lay spread out. Night had fully fallen while Rohan, Korra, and the Acolytes had saddled the Bison, and the city blazed with light, its golden nightglow calling that of New Avalon to mind. Beyond the skyline, a gibbous moon was just rising, framed in one of the passes through the mountains that backed the city. At this angle it seemed huge, bigger than Sephiro's moon, perhaps the size of Bajor in Gerardo's night sky. Its silver light seemed to highlight the city's golden glow rather than compete with it. "Not bad," Utna agreed. Corwin looked thoughtful for a second, then rezzed up his quarry and omni-tool and futzed with it for a few seconds. The tool's holographic UI flicked to its much smaller passive mode as antique music began issuing from nowhere evident.
"I like to dream, yes, right between the sound machine. On the cloud of sound, I drift in the night. Any place it goes is right. Goes far, flies near, looks lost away from here. Well, you don't know what we can find. Why don't you come with me, little girl, on a magic carpet ride? You don't know what we can see. Why don't you tell your dreams to me? Fantasy will set you free."
Laughing, Utna climbed over the pommel of the saddle and down onto Mogi's neck, such as it was. The animal's thick fur made for purchase almost as secure as that of the saddle itself, and she had no worries as she made her way down until she was hugging Corwin from behind. "I take back what I said a second ago," she murmured, her chin on his shoulder. "It's not bad. It's amazing." "It is that," said Corwin contentedly. They were passing another island now, smaller than Air Temple Island and featuring only a single building. This was a fairly low structure, not that impressive in its own right, but atop it stood a colossal statue of a young man in robes very similar to Rohan's, striking a dramatic, forward-leaning pose with a staff in one hand. "Cool statue," Utna observed. "Who is it?" Corwin grinned. "That's Aang, Republic City's founder. He's my second favorite avatar. He was the one before Korra." "You make it sound like you've met him," said Utna, amused. "I have," Corwin replied. And then, before she could pursue that line further, "Hang on. Have to do a little maneuvering to get into the traffic pattern here." Indeed, the airspace above the city itself, as opposed to out over the bay, did seem to have regular traffic patterns, like those followed by the airship and aircar traffic of New Avalon. No one seemed to think it was all that strange that the pattern had just been joined by a huge flying animal with two people aboard. People waved to them from the windows of airship gondolas and took photos. For a few seconds, they were paced by a long black Zeppelin with police markings, but the officers aboard apparently found no fault with their navigation, because after a block or so it peeled off and went on its way uptown. "That was some pretty serious-looking hardware," Utna observed. "Cops in these parts don't fool around." No indeed," Corbin agreed. "I wonder what that building by the waterfront is," she mused. "The one that's all gold-colored. It looks like it might be a temple or something." Corwin didn't even have to look. There was only one place in town she could mean. "That's Shiro Shinobi Arena. It's a temple, all right. A temple of sport. Major League Bending, Danger Ball. I think they even configured it for an Earth Rumble once. Remind me, we'll check the sports page in the morning." I think it's the MLB off-season right now, but they might be doing spring training or exhibition matches or something. And even if they're not, there's the Pro Bending Hall of Fame. They took a lap of the city, much as they had done of New Avalon, first on the ground and then in Corwin's own little Zeppelin, during that first Christmas vacation they had known each other. The thought wasn't far from either one's mind as Corwin guided Mogi out of the traffic pattern at the end of the lap and toward a downtown building that was, though not one of the tallest skyscrapers in town, certainly among the most arresting. There was something of the Gothic about its architecture, which would have made it stand out against the rest of the skyline, even if it hadn't been clad in some highly polished bright red stone, trimmed in gold and brilliantly floodlit. Enormous golden letters set into the building's facade at the top announced its name. Phoenix House Hotel. Mogi landed in front of the canopied main entrance as if it were a perfectly ordinary thing to be doing, and grunted an amiable greeting to the startled doorman. This worthy did his best, but even he, a jaded veteran of everything one of the city's poshest hotels could throw at a man, couldn't help but be taken aback by the arrival of two strangely dressed foreigners who were definitely not air nomads on an air nomad sky bison. One was a powerfully built young man who might have been a water tribesman, if not for his very fair skin. The other a tall, slim young woman at whose ethnicity he could not even begin to guess. He had never in his life seen anyone with pink hair before, and some part of him refused to believe it was natural. Corwin climbed back onto Mogi's saddle to retrieve their bags, then let himself down the animal's side and went around to receive Utina as she alighted from Mogi's head. Bright-eyed, she thanked Mogi for the beautiful ride. Corwin grinned, added his own thanks, and then said, "You'd better head back to the island, buddy. I don't think they'll have anything here you want to eat. Don't worry, I'll be back in a couple days." He rubbed the bison's nose affectionately. "Now that I know what it means to you, I'm not going to run out on you again."
"Run,"
Mogi replied. Then he turned, gathered himself, and launched into the sky, sailing away to the west and back out toward the bay. Said the doorman. Then, seeming to recall his duty, he opened one of the great brass-bound glass doors and bowed them inside, saying, "Welcome to the Phoenix House Hotel." "Thank you," said Utina pleasantly. Corwin nodded to him, and they went on through. Inside, the lobby of the Phoenix House was done up in the sort of style one would expect from looking at the outside of the building. Lots of golden and copper trim, red leather, and lashings of that black-veined red stone. As Utina looked around, she noticed that there were things that looked like exhibits and display cases scattered around the vast, echoey space, as if in a museum. Pride of place in the center went to a giant photograph that appeared to have been tinted by hand, a full story high and spanning the full width of the lobby, that was mounted up on the atrium wall above the reception desk. This depicted 8 people, 3 men and 5 women, 7 of them in what looked like old-fashioned hard-shell spacesuits, and one of the women, dressed in very smart, slightly archaic-looking business attire. With a blink and a surprised sound, Utina realized that one of the space-suited women, holding her fishbowl helmet under her arm and grinning a by-now-familiar jaunty grin, was Cora. Corwin stopped next to her and looked up at the photo, smiling. "The crew of the Phoenix flight," he said. "I may have mentioned to Cora at some point that you're an early spaceflight buff." They went to the front desk, where the desk clerk, an attractive young woman, neatly attired all in shades of red, her dark hair styled to frame her face, gave them the sort of look desk clerks in fancy hotels give people who show up dressed the way Corwin and Utina were dressed. Unlike the doorman, she didn't seem too interested in how exotic they looked, but then not being too interested was, of course, part of her job. May I help you? She asked, sounding as though she suspected the answer was probably no, but was willing to give it a shot. Corwin took Cora's card from his pocket, placed it on the counter, and slid it toward her with his fingertips, saying, I believe we have a reservation. The clerk raised one immaculately trimmed eyebrow at him, her amber eyes skeptical. Then she looked at the card, blinked once, and so perfectly retained her composure that Corwin felt an irrational urge to kiss her. Of course, she said, as though that had been obvious all along. Then, smiling fractionally, but fully, it reached her eyes. She struck a brass call bell smartly and said, Front! A bellman appeared with a bronze cart, upon which Corwin had eaten his bags, once he'd placed them there, looked comically small. Meanwhile, the clerk slid a large, brass-edged, leather-bound book across the counter, along with an elaborate pen and an upright holder, and what appeared to be an extremely high-end version of the kind of inking pad people used to use with rubber stamps. Corwin smiled at her, took the pen, and signed the guest register as neatly as he ever could. Then he handed the pen to Utrina, who outdid him easily, signing her name with a beautifully curlicued flourish that put him in mind of ancient revolutionary documents. He felt a little thrill as he noticed that she'd signed herself Utrina R. Tenjo, something he'd never seen her do before. You're in the Avatar suite, of course, said the clerk, a little warmth edging into her voice now, as she took back the book and implements, then presented Corwin with a large, ornate brass key and a narrow white envelope. Senjo will show you up. My name is Azana, and if there's anything you need, please don't hesitate to dial 0 and ask for me. Then she really smiled, showing very white teeth, and added, Have a wonderful evening. Thank you, said Corwin with a smile of his own. He made a gesture not unlike several others Utrina had seen tonight, linking his hands before his chest with the fingers interlocked and bowing slightly. With a raised eyebrow, Azana replied with the firebender salute, and Utrina, slightly at a loss, bowed in the Nihonian style, arms at her sides. She thought out in a hurry, Utrina murmured wryly to Corwin as they followed Senjo to the elevator. Fire Nation girls, he replied casually. They just need to know you're not wasting their time. Do I want to know how you know that? She asked as they entered the lift. I'm a keen student of other cultures, you know that, said Corwin. She looked like she might remonstrate with him, if only jokingly, but with Senjo at the lever, the elevator was startlingly fast for its evident vintage, and she was too busy being delighted by that to bother as they shot up to what must have been near the top of the building. The short corridor at their destination had only one door, directly opposite the gate of the lift. Senjo waited for Corwin to unlock this, then bowed them through and followed them in with the baggage cart, placed their bags within, and departed with a deep bow. For a moment, once the lift gate had rattled shut and the elevator departed with a mechanical whine, Corwin and Utrina stood in the middle of the Avatar suite's sitting room, looking around. The room was tastefully decorated in a very different style from the hotel's common areas, mostly in much cooler hues, blues and creamy off-whites, with a darker blue and whiter white sawtooth pattern on the walls, just above head height, and dark wood paneling above, up to a coffered ceiling. This, Corwin knew, was the style of the Southern Water Tribe, Korra's native culture. Her house in the South Pole settlement of Senna looked much like it on the inside, or had when he'd last been there some 8 years before. As he studied the room, though, he noticed subtle accents hearkening back to the other peoples of Dicho. The planters, for instance, had the cheerful solidity of the Earth Kingdom about them, while the wrought iron light sconces on the walls owed their elegant lines to the Fire Nation, and the elaborately decorated wood-framed paper screen walling off the dining table and chairs in the corner from the rest of the room was pure air nomad. Someone had put a lot of thought and care into making the Avatar suite reflect its namesake's makeup. A proud daughter of the South Pole, but one connected to every other nation and culture in the world. Utrinna didn't have the background for any of this yet, though Corwin knew that sometime in the next 48 hours, she would ask and he would tell her. For now, she just looked around, taking it all in on its own merits. "This is amazing," she said. "Yes, it is," Corwin agreed. "What's in the envelope she gave you?" Utrinna asked. Then, as he tore the end flap open, she smirked and added, "Probably her phone number." "I already know her phone number. It's zero," he replied, earning a light punch in the arm. "Let's see here. The envelope proved to contain three objects, a small note, and a pair of items that had the appearance of visiting cards. Corwin read the note, then handed it to Utrinna while he examined the two cards. "Guys, I took the liberty of arranging dinner for you tomorrow night. Don't worry, after that the suggestions stop. You're completely on your own for Sunday." Happy face. "It's a little bit of a poodle pony show, but I promise it'll be totally worth it. See you Monday. Lots of love. Cora." Said Utrinna, intrigued. She looked at the cards in Corwin's hands. Both were covered in tiny, crisp, tongue-y characters, whose meaning Utrinna could only guess at. "What are they?" she wondered. "This one," said Corwin, holding up the one with writing on only one side, "is a reservation card for the fanciest restaurant in the city, where we are expected at 7:30 tomorrow evening. And this one," he went on, holding up the one with black writing on one side and an elaborate red seal-like marking on the other, "recommends that we present ourselves at Ming and Daughters, Clothiers, no later than 5 o'clock, so that we'll be properly dressed for the occasion." "Wow, a restaurant with a dress code," said Utrinna. "We haven't done that in a while." "Nope," Corwin agreed, placing the cards carefully in the top pocket of his black and gray checked wool jacket. "Think we'll be able to pass?" "Of course not," Utrinna replied, grinning. "That's half the fun." Giving him a kiss, she picked up their bags and carried them into what she guessed, correctly, was the bedroom. This was done in the same style as the sitting room, with a bedspread on the king-size bed that put her in mind of the dress Cora had worn at the wedding, deep royal blue trimmed in white fur. Smiling, she put the bags down in the closet, kicked off her shoes, and padded back out to the sitting room in her stocking feet to find Corwin sitting on the sofa, thumbing through a large book. "What you got there?" she asked, sitting down beside him and pulling her feet up. "Complimentary coffee table book," he said, handing it to her. It was a big, heavy volume with pages of glossy paper, the kind of book that would be full of crisply reproduced photos. That was good, since the text appeared to be in Chinese, which she couldn't read. "It's a history of Project Phoenix Flight, the historical event this hotel is named after. It was basically Decho's equivalent of Project Apollo on Earth, the first trip by people from Decho to their moon." Utrinna's eyebrows went up. "Fantastic," she said. "I don't suppose there's a standard edition. Or a Klingonese one," she added wryly. "I'm not sure, but if not, I can hit the highlights for you. Right now, though, what I was actually looking for was this," Corwin added, picking up the other large book from the low table in front of the couch. He opened it to reveal a page covered in mixed Chinese and standard, part of the hotel's room service menu. "Aha," said Utrinna, her eyes twinkling. "Good call. History will have to wait." She put the glossy book back on the table and snuggled up against him to peruse the menu. "No idea what most of this stuff is," she mused. "That must be the cocktails. cactus juice? Corwin snorted. Best saved for another time, I think. He said, I was thinking that if we're at the Phoenix House, we should try the Phoenix House stir-fry. It's one of those signature hotel dishes in Dicho, like Potatoes Imperial or Parker House Rolls back home. I've had it before, but never actually at the Phoenix House. Sounds like a plan, said Utrinim. She picked up the phone, which was on the table at her end of the sofa, and handed the handset to him, then dialed 0 and waited while he had a very pleasant conversation with first Azana, then the kitchen staff. A startlingly short time later, their meal arrived. The crisply uniformed pair who delivered it, a young man and woman who looked like they might be siblings, not only brought it into the room, but served it on the table in the corner, departing only when they were absolutely certain that everything had been prepared and presented to the honored guest's satisfaction. Like Senjo, they left with deep bows, neither expecting nor awaiting a gratuity. Utrinna and Corwin dined as if at a fancy restaurant, which was a curious feeling in stocking feet, cargo shorts, and partly unbuttoned. Only partly, for the service had been very fast. Baseball jerseys. The food was fantastic, spicy without brutality, and the wine, which they hadn't ordered, and which had simply appeared with the staff's felicitations, superb. With the meal finished and the dishes, stacked neatly back on the tray, placed out in the hall, they found themselves once again standing in the middle of the sitting room, looking around at the calming and tasteful decor of the Avatar suite. Then Corwin said, I'm about to do something horribly old-fashioned and patriarchal. I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. Excuse me? Said Utrinna, and then he'd swept her up in his arms and carried her into the bedroom. Once there, he set her back on her feet again and stood smiling boyishly at her. She put her fists on her hips and tried to look severe, but it just wasn't happening. Then she came to his arms, or he came to hers, and they didn't do much more thinking about the decor that night. Back on Air Temple Island, having seen Mogi return to the Bison Caves, packed everyone else off to bed, and finished up her evening practice, Korra sat on the ridgepole of the White Lotus sentry station, from which the guardsmen maintained their vigil over the eastern approaches to the island. This had long been one of her favorite spots to sit and think in the evening. The place where she sat had been worn smooth over the years by the seats of who knew how many pairs of her trousers. The view of Republic City from up here was unparalleled from anywhere other than the top of the Air Temple itself. Deliciously, happily tired after 2 long days, and she didn't even want to calculate the time changes, Korra smiled fondly and made the Water Tribe salute in the general direction of the Phoenix House's shining red tower, then turned, walked to the far end of the ridgepole, sprang lightly down to the ground, and headed for bed. Saturday, March 13th, 2410. Morning found Caitlin, Juniper, and Serge in the paved martial arts practice area near where they had first arrived in Dicho the night before. Serge was lounging by the edge, watching with the air of a not very interested observer as his mistress and her student performed kata with blunt weapons, bokuto for Anne, sheathed satoichi for Kate. Unnoticed, or at least unacknowledged, by either woman, a small crowd of young airbenders and air acolytes had gathered around the tiger to watch them work along with him. Presently they paused, bowed to each other, and put up their weapons as Korra joined them, alighting from an airbender glider, like Rohan had used, and collapsing it into a staff as she landed. Good morning, you two, she said cheerfully. Good morning, Korra, said Kate. We missed you at breakfast. Korra chuckled, shouldering her glider staff. I got kind of a late start, and then I had to go into town and take care of a few things. Here, she said, rummaging in an inside pocket of her blue leather jacket. Here's all the stuff you'll need. This is a letter of introduction to the headmaster of the Firebending Academy, she said, handing Anne a letter sealed with an old-fashioned adhesive wafer. I also got you a map and a couple of badger mole cards, Cora went on, giving Kate a rolled-up document and a small waxed pasteboard card, the latter decorated with a gaily colored cartoon image of the eponymous animal. For the subway, she explained to Anne's curious look. She held up the other card, then handed it over. Cheaper than taking a taxi everywhere. I suppose you could ride Sergei, but I don't think he's anywhere near big enough.
Hmm,
said Serge, eyeing the avatar dubiously.
I kid, said Cora, crossing to give him a scritching.
Say, why are you guys all hanging around here? She asked the small group of youngsters gathered around him. The kids all glanced at each other, silently selecting a spokesman through a combination of eye gestures and subtle jostling, until finally one of the airbenders among them, a boy of around 13, spoke up.
The Sword Ladies are using our Bagua Circle, he said diffidently.
Oh, said Kate, crossing the ring to stand by Cora.
Sorry, why didn't you say something? There was no one out here when we finished breakfast, so I'm afraid we sort of helped ourselves.
Oh, it's no problem, said the boy, evidently warming to her friendly demeanor. Master Milo hasn't shown up anyway. He's probably sleeping in again.
Cora looked thoughtful.
I wouldn't be so...
She trailed off, cocking her head as if listening for something. Then, suddenly galvanized into action, she spun so that her back was to the children and shouted,
"Incoming!"
Several objects were indeed coming their way, lofting down from the upper levels of the Air Temple's tower. Caitlin automatically stepped into formation with Cora, her blade singing from its wooden cover. Out of the corner of her eye, she noticed the boy and a couple of the other youngsters goggling at it. Anne slung her bokuto, figuring that whatever these objects were, she was probably better equipped to deal with them empty-handed. Her jaw set in a look of fierce determination, Cora took a step forward and whirled her staff before her like a rotor blade, intercepting all four of the incoming objects at once. They instantly disintegrated, creating a great spray of multicolored semi-liquid that flew outward in a broad arc to either side, covering the ground in a wide stripe. Some of it carried on through the disc of the spinning staff. Most of this fairly comprehensively splattered Cora. A bit sprayed off to the sides, flecking Kate and a couple of the children. Putting her sword away, Kate sniffed thoughtfully at a blob of the stuff on her hand, then licked it off, considered, and said,
Orangeberry.
A moment later, a squadron of flying lemurs arrived, descending upon the distributed pie filling like cleanup crews on an oil spill, though Anne noticed they gave Serge, who was also taking an interest in the patch nearest him, a wide berth. Cora blinked through the mask of pie filling covering her face and said pleasantly,
"Would you excuse me for a second? I have to go threaten a sweet old man with bodily harm. Back in a jiffy. Gyatso, hold this."
So saying, she handed her, slightly sticky, staff to the boy who had spoken for the others, shaped what appeared to be a large ball of whirling, compressed air with her hands, and jumped on top of it as it sped away toward the tower.
"Exunt," pursued by lemurs.
Whoever was up there apparently still had some ammo, but Cora was really motoring now, and wouldn't be put off by a mere bombardment of pastry. She went straight up the side of the tower, avoiding a couple of pies and blasting others to flavorful clouds before they could reach her, then sprang up onto a high balcony and disappeared inside. She emerged a few moments later with a skinny figure in the robes of a master airbender at her side, jumped down from the balcony, and broke their fall with a blast of air and a neatly lifted slab of pavement. This became stairs for them to walk down to ground level, then collapsed back to its normal elevation behind them as they walked over to the Bagua circle.
Unhand me, young lady.
The airbender, bald like Rohan, whom he rather resembled, but sporting a white goatee instead of a gray mustache, grumbled as Korra walked him over to the group, a hand on the scruff of his neck.
You need to learn to respect your elders.
Korra sighed, rolling her eyes.
Milo. Fine, fine. I suppose it's time for our morning lessons anyway, isn't it, children?
He inquired. Straightening his robes ostentatiously as Korra released him, he added with a bland smile,
Korra, dear, you've got a little fruit on you.
Korra eyed him narrowly. Then, with a sudden percussive gust of wind, all the fruit that had been on her was on him. Not anymore, Korra deadpanned. The old man laughed uproariously for a few seconds, then subsided, wiping tears and pie-filling from his eyes, and declared,
Well played, my love, well played. We'll call this round a draw, shall we?
Then, turning to Kate and Anne, he smiled brightly and said,
And you must be our guests, or, well, two of them.
He made the airbender salute to them and went on,
I am Master Milo. Milo the Ancient, the youngsters call me when they think I can't hear them.
To the side, Gyatso blushed and looked unconvincingly nonchalant.
Charmed. You are a very beautiful young woman, and it's not weird of me to say so.
Leaving Kate and Anne to ponder that, they weren't even sure which of them he'd been addressing, he clapped his hands briskly and shouted,
Lemurs! To me! Clean up on Master Milo!
Obediently, lemurs arrived and began removing the pulverized fruit from the aged master. Korra bade him an exaggeratedly civil farewell that didn't quite cover a half-smile, took her staff back from Gyatso, and led the two samurai and tiger away from the Bagua circle.
So that was Milo, she said tiredly.
What an interesting fellow, said Kate diplomatically. Tenjo Academy, Sephiro. By noon, the campus of Tenjo Academy was back to something like normal. Most of the visitors who had come for Corwin or Newton's wedding had gone back whence they came sometime in the morning. The crew of students detailed for cleanup and restoration of the school's normal settings had long since completed their work, and the only major remaining trace of the festivities was the giant hot tub in the middle of the quad. This, its creator having left the world without being asked to return the area to its original state, looked like being a permanent feature after all. Nall Silverclaw roamed the deserted corridors of East Hall, checking to see if there was anyone from the Midgard duelist contingent still at large. Most, he knew, had gone back with the Rune Knights as guides, earlier in the morning, while he'd still been in bed. There was always the possibility that a few others had opted to go back to sleep rather than heed the early wake-up call, knowing that he was still around to take them back later on. And indeed there were. Nall found his two stragglers in the common room, watching the last of the Avalon 17 Saturday morning cartoons on the giant holoset. They were a couple of the new generation from Gerardo, the tall Scottish girl and her English boyfriend, who between them had kicked a lot of Earth Force ass and earned a lot of duelist cred on Tau Ceti. Having seen the way they handled that crazy fest without batting an eye, Nall figured they'd be well up for his little errand, and anyone who would bother figuring out how to work Corwin's interdimensional pirate cable TV receiver just to watch My Little Destroid had to be decent company. Hey, guys, he said from the doorway.
Oh, hey, Nall, said Rory Williams from the depths of the center couch.
Are you guys it? Nall wondered.
Yeah, everybody else headed back this morning,
Amy Pond confirmed from even deeper in the couch. Nall moseyed into the room and made himself at home in one of the armchairs to watch the rest of the show.
At noon, the cartoons gave way to the 12 o'clock news. Amy surfed the channels for a while, found nothing of interest, and gave up in disgust, switching the set off.
"Well, what do you say, Guy?" she asked, thumping Rory lightly on the leg. "Suppose we ought to get a move on ourselves."
"You guys have any special plans for the week?" asked Noll.
"Not really," said Rory.
"Why?"
"Well," Noll said, "I've got this errand to run for my boy Corwin. Got to deliver a mysterious package to a far-off foreign land."
He grinned.
"I thought maybe you guys might want a piece of that action."
Amy and Rory looked at each other speculatively, then got to their feet.
"Sounds better than going back to Gerardo and taking an 8-day nap," Amy quipped.
"Great," said Noll, rising. "Be good to have the company. It'll be a long train ride, but the view's nice."
Rory put up a hand in the hang-on-a-second gesture.
"We're going someplace you have to go by train. From here."
"Well, no, not from here," Noll admitted. "We'll take the Rose Gate from here to Saikyo on Zipang, and from there we take the train."
Amy's green eyes went wide.
"To Dicho," she blurted.
Noll raised an eyebrow at her.
"You guys know about Dicho?"
Yeah, said Amy hesitantly. "We went there. Once."
"Long time ago," Rory put in.
Amy nodded.
"Yeah, long time."
Noll thought that over for a second. Amy and Rory were sophomores in high school. What constituted a long time for them? Then said,
"Huh, interesting.
You speak Tongyu?"
"He does," said Amy, tilting her head at Rory.
"Sort of," Rory qualified.
"I just speak standard more slowly," Amy added.
"And louder," supplied Rory, earning himself an elbow in the ribs.
"Huh," Noll repeated.
"Well, okay. Actually, you should be good to go with standard there these days. Go grab your gear and meet me at Utna and Anthe's room. I've got to collect the mysterious package."
As they were leaving the common room, he remarked,
"I hope I still have admin access to the elevator. I do not want to lug that thing up all those stairs."